our friend, the talented author Colin Fleming, to talk Beatles, because there ain't nobody out there who can talk and write about the Beatles like Colin can. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, how's it going, Kimball?
Very well, thank you. Good to have you with us this afternoon. You have written, well, you've published 8 books. You've got, I don't know how many more in the queue waiting for some non-clueless publisher to pick them up and run with them. Of all the books, I am so excited about the book you're working on, The Beatles, that'll be called Giving You Everything, A Hard Day's Night and the Artistic Zenith of the Beatles. And it looks at the Beatles in a way that nobody else has and nobody else can.
I think that's true. It sounds strange to say this about something from so many decades ago, but there's definitely a recency bias with the Beatles, where there's an emphasis on their music from 1967, the year of Sgt. Pepper, on as the best music they made. So, like, when I was in high school, and you were into cool music, the Doors and the Rolling Stones and the Velvet Underground and the Beatles and things of that nature, you weren't going to cite A Hard Day's Night or With the Beatles as your favorite Beatles albums. You're going to be edgier. And so the Beatles were getting into more overt sex and drugs to go along with the rock and roll, with Pepper, with the White Album, and on until the end of their career. And then if you're in the car driving around and you're listening, you're not with your parents and you weren't listening to the oldies station, you'd be hearing the Beatles on classic rock radio. So from 67 on is sort of when the 1960s went from black and white, in a sense, that Kansas setting of The Wizard of Oz, to Oz itself and full-blown Technicolor. At least that's how it's perceived. And because we're such a lazy people and we're such an unthinking people, and we don't challenge things and we don't put forth any effort to revisit anything or visit something for the first time even, people have turned their collective backs on those early Beatles. And I've been listening to the Beatles for a long time, and I've been writing about them professionally for a long time. And finally, I just gave up the struggle that I had within myself. And it would seem odd that me, of all people, would be doing this, but I just decided to give up the ghost that the later Beatles were the better Beatles, because they're not. I don't think the Beatles were ever better than they were at the time of A Hard Day's Night. It's the only album written entirely by Lennon and McCartney, and the things that they were doing were so innovative, and I think more innovative in that time period, and just more innovative overall than what they did later on, which isn't to knock anything from later on. The White Album is probably my all-time favorite official album, but I don't think there's anything better than A Hard Day's Night, which cues to my theory that a work of art is as good as the level of energy it contains, or it can't be better than that. And I have never heard an album, any musical statement by anyone that contains more energy, possesses more energy than A Hard Day's Night, the record.
I wonder too, Colin, if some of that recency bias is fueled by McCartney himself. I caught an interview over the weekend from a couple of years ago, but he was talking about some of those early songs and Not that he dissed them, but he said, you know, we were pleading with the audience. We were writing to them, asking them to love us. And I felt like he was giving even some of their own songs a bit of short shrift.
There's a degree, I'd say, of that with how much they emphasize pronouns early on, from me to you, I'll get you, things like that. But when they wrote She Loves You, there's nothing that could have prepared you for the advent of She Loves You. There is nothing that shocks in the history of popular recorded sound like She Loves You. It is an outrageous way to write a song, to perform a song. The chords are outrageous. The way it starts is outrageous. It is such a bravura moment of, well, really, this isn't trying to be vulgar. It's just balls, Kimball. It's just going for something that everyone would tell you, who would purport to know, that you can't do. There is nothing that gets you ready for that. Now, we had Elvis at Sun, and he was such a radical modernist, but you can look to antecedents of what Elvis was doing. They might not have gotten you ready for Mystery Train, but you could have heard earlier versions of rockabilly and certainly Delta blues and gospel and that dark, deep-souled country music, and he mixed them all together. She Loves You is not a mix of anything. She Loves You is just new. It's like we look to the horizons and we think we know the stars and the planets and the comets and the moons and all of those things, and then there's just something new up there. That's what She Loves You was, and that's just one example. And you know what? People are going to, they're going to follow what everyone else is saying. Have you ever like been online and you read an honest review of something that you know sucks? It's really bad. And that first customer has come out and really broken down why it's so bad. And they're not things that you don't know. Have you noticed all the people that piggyback on the review and they express their gratitude? Thank you for saying this. I thought this. I didn't want to put it out there. I didn't want anyone to think this or that about me. I think that's what happens with the early Beatles in a sort of regard, too, that it really takes one person to flip the script. And that's what I have in mind with this book.
We're talking Beatles with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We're coming up on the anniversary this weekend of a landmark recording session, February 11th, 1963, 60 years ago, and really it's what became the first two Beatles albums.
It's what became the first Beatles album, Please Please Me. And so there's not going to be anything from with the Beatles yet. There are Please Please Me itself, the single, that's in the can, that's going to be on the album. So it's not, strictly speaking, the entirety of the album. It's going to be the bulk of the album. It's a 585-minute long session. And the expectation in place at this point in time for the Beatles was, there really was no expectation. This could be a one and done. We'd have to see how it went. And I was thinking today, because the album is a mix of originals and it's a mix of covers, and it is one of your best rock and roll albums, but it's an album where we see influences of the Beatles that they're transcending. I was talking to a friend and the subject of influences came up, and I said to him, could you even imagine if I said to you, or you, like it was an interview, and I said, oh yes, I was really influenced by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Like the idea of influences is so foreign to me as someone who doesn't have influences. And so part of the reason I was talking about She Loves You there was, there's no influence that helps you make She Loves You, but there are influences in evidence with Please Please Me, because you kind of pasted an album together. It wasn't thought of as a cohesive statement. If it worked out to be a cohesive statement, that was just luck or chance or the way the songs fell. And I was thinking like, okay, so you come to the period of the Strokes. Imagine if Is This It was a mix of Strokes, originals, and covers. Like there's a shortened cover of Marquee Moon by Television or something. It would have been really strange, but this wasn't strange. This was strange because there were some originals, like half of the album, essentially, were originals on this album. So it's one marathon session. Lennon has a cold. We have to do it today, boys. And this is just what we're slapping out there.
And you get, yeah, such a great mix of styles and feelings here. I think you could easily make a case that I Saw Her Standing There is the best opening cut on a debut album that anybody has ever recorded.
It's definitely in that. It's definitely in that conversation, and they had had this for a while. We can go back to a rehearsal at the Cavern Club the year before, in 1962, which we've discussed on this program before, where they're doing a version of "I Saw Her Standing There." The wonderful Star Club tapes, which I had written about recently for who was it? The New York Post, as an op-ed at the end of last year, has a version of "I Saw Her Standing There." And it's actually an edit. It's not like really that Countin was grafted on to the take that they used to start the album. But we can see how much they excelled as writers. It's that line, she was just 17, if you know what I mean. That says a lot about life, being a certain age, looking back on being that age. And just encapsulates a lot that, if you know what I mean. It's very conversational, but there is just so much sagacity in that line. And that was a track that George Martin accurately called the pot boiler. And that's how Beatles albums tended to start. We can go through the White Album back in the USSR. It's a potboiler. They're still adhering to the I Saw Her Standing There idea of this is how you start a record. It's like when Orson Welles mentioned this before. He talked about a film. A film has to start at the top of its bent. And I feel like an album has to start that way, too. But you know what? So does a book. So does a short story. You have to start at the top of the bend. And then you build from there. And building from there doesn't mean going up. You can build in other directions. You can build going down a level, not qualitatively, just in terms of the arc, the shape of what you're doing. So, yeah, there are all of these outstanding outtakes, different run-throughs, because it's really a concert. That's what this session is. It's a concert in the studio where the Beatles are saying, did you like that one? Let's do it five more times. That's really how it works.
And boy, the covers are such a great mix. Arthur Alexander's And a Go to Him, Goffin and King's Chains, a cover of A Taste of Honey, who would have expected that? And then, of course, their unbelievable version, better than the original of Twist and Shout.
The Beatles at this point in time were misogynists who had a feminist streak when it came to their art. You're supposed to be a tough guy back in the day. You were supposed to be a leather-clad tough guy. You weren't supposed to admit of any softness or anything of that nature, and you weren't supposed to cover girl group songs. It's really among the male groups, it's only the Beatles who were doing this. Like Arthur Alexander? It's tough guy stuff. That's like a cool black guy. And the Rolling Stones and Jerry and the Pacemakers even did Where Have You Been All My Life. So that was an easy go-to. But the Shirelles, that was different. A Taste of Honey, other groups would have looked at that as mawkish. The Beatles were very fortunate in a way to grow up when they did, to be able to experience all of these different forms of music. And the BBC is just so central to what the Beatles did. It was central in terms of their sessions themselves, which without, I don't think they would have been the band that they were. I don't think they would have reached the artistic levels that they did. And it also allowed them to hear all of these amazing things, and you listen to what was on. We had talked before about a Beatles session. So there was an idea that they were going to be pretty good at this February 11th session. We had heard them before in January of 63 doing Little Eva's Keep Your Hands Off My Baby, cover of a Stephen Foster song even that they performed. So some other guy. They were ready to go. They were tight. They were in the groove. They get into the studio. Twist and Shout is, of course, like the famous number and the famous one take. And the Beatles were very good at one takes. Kansas City later on in 1964 is another one take performance. And there you go.
Want to listen to a song that you don't hear much out of the Beatles collection through the years, and it's from that opening recording session, and then I want to get your thoughts on it. Here's a little bit of the Beatles doing There's a Place.
There's a place.
That great solo there by John Lennon. I don't know why we don't hear that song more often. It's such a great performance.
It's the first mature, grown-up song in rock and roll history. Full stop. I don't know how else someone could argue otherwise. The road to Strawberry Fields Forever and A Day in the Life is paved with the outtakes of There's a Place. And listen to how, in that excerpt there, when Lennon goes hard and he really nails that word love. And the background singers, at the very moment that he's going into that word, they rise up above. You create that sonic depth of field. It's very Orson Welles-like, in fact. It's very Citizen Kane-like, except rather than it being done pictorially, it's being done musically. Lennon has the cold. You can hear his voice break at one point during that. But again, it's that idea of going for it. This is a song of intense interiority. And we didn't have songs like that in February of 1963. And listen to the way he sings the word I. It's given four syllables.
Mm.
It's that emphasis on the self. This just was not done. This place that the singer is going to is not to the sock hop. It's not to hook up with some girl at the balcony at the cinema. The place is inside of himself. It's the self. This is a heady, Thoreau-esque concept for these early 20-somethings who were older than their actual years in England, repressed, buttoned-down England of all places. Still, in a way, that was the post-war frame of mind in the winter of 63.
Musically, I feel like it owes a fair amount to the Brill Building pop that they loved so much. But to me, it's that lyrical difference that makes it stand out.
That's part of it. But if you listen, it has that chunk-a-chunk rhythm guitar from Lennon. And you wouldn't get that groove. Really, a lot of the Beatles' groove was based off of the rhythm guitar. No one talks about it because Lennon was no instrumental technician. But he was driving the band. And I think that's something, too, that people don't get into much. That frees up Ringo Starr. We hear a lot of fills there. I'm not saying he's Keith Moon, but he wasn't just this rote timekeeper, which was all Pete Best. Pete Best didn't even have it in him to be that. It was just a really withering comment that Lennon had made about Pete Best. That was cruel. There was really no need to make it. But he said that we got back from Germany and essentially we taught this guy how to make a stick go up and down. And that's all he could do. So it's true in a way. It's borne out. And if you listen to Pete Best, most of his playing with the Beatles that survives. But Ringo Starr is making that cut drive. And it's an album has all of these different components to it. We talked about the Potboiler. Twist and Shout is the famous closer. Twist and Shout is set up by the penultimate cut, and There's a Place. Twist and Shout gains some of its power from what There's a Place does. It's like that player on the field who makes his teammates better. That's how a work of art works. That's how the middle of a movie sets up the next part of the movie. That's how the first sentence sets up the second sentence. And that's how Please Please Me works, too.
And to go from where they were there in February of 63 to, well, less than 18 months later to A Hard Day's Night, that's a journey that some groups could obviously never make if they played together for 20 years.
To go from Please Please Me to With the Beatles. And With the Beatles has a completely different feel than Please Please Me. Please Please Me is, okay, this is our live act. There's not going to be a ton of finesse. We're in the studio. Let's just cut this. With the Beatles has more studio sophistication to it. It has, I think of it as the ultimate white rhythm and blues album. It's rhythm and blues. That's really the theme of With the Beatles. Get to A Hard Day's Night, and these two guys are going to write all of the songs, and they're going to be completely original, not just by composition, but stylistically. You have this album where it works continuously. It's a well-blended album, but it still, at the same time, paradoxically has these two distinctive halves. The second half of A Hard Day's Night is quite somber shaded, but if you think about this, they have to write these original songs. They're writing as scoring composers, in a sense, because the movie's happening. That's the other thing the book is about. It's about both of them. The movie's happening around the same time, so they know that there's going to be a film, and Lennon and McCartney race out of the studio because they were competing with each other to get the title track. We hate competition now. Their friendship also is at its apex. Their rivalry is at its apex. Not an easy blend to maintain. But where do they sort of turn for an influence that no one can detect? They turn to skiffle. Think about I Should Have Known Better in the Hard Day's Night film, the sequence where there's that magical realism almost. It's like this Jean Vigo absurdism where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, without taking them out, they have instruments in their hands, and they're in mid-song. But that's a very skiffly, homemade type of sound. Now, you wouldn't notice it because it's sort of dressed up with that amazing invention of the chords they're using, the way the album itself starts with really the chord of chords in all of popular music that A Day in the Life isn't going to surpass. It's simply going to mirror and invert by using that same chord, that idea of the chord, as the conclusion of its song, whereas this starts a sort of chord-based symphonic rocking of the zeitgeist. And it's all in that chord from the start. And we have skiffle mixed through with all of that. I just don't know how popular music can get more exciting than A Hard Day's Night.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's a pretty Lennon-heavy album when it comes to the writing.
Lennon, at this point in their career, it's another thing that tends to be lost on people because you have to get into the details and the nuance. He is the leader. It is his band. It's still his turf, and it's still going to be his turf at the end. We get to the long medley on Abbey Road, and they're each playing guitar solos. We get 9 solos all together, each guy going 3 times. Why do you think Lennon went last? He went last because he's like, okay, I'm the leader. This is, and they defer to him. So at this point, he's highly productive. He's not as laissez-faire, let's say, in his own intense interiority with the drugs, and he's driven. He's a guy who is getting what he has wanted to get, and again, he's going for it. And another Lennon-dominated album is Rubber Soul, and that's the last time he's going to dominate. Revolver is the McCartney album, and it sort of becomes, okay, most of these songs are mine, and then Lennon's going to have key songs. That's how A Hard Day's Night works. Most of them are Lennon, but Can't Buy Me Love is McCartney. Things We Said Today is McCartney. These are important songs, especially Can't Buy Me Love. Can't Buy Me Love was this bell cow of a hit. It was like to 1964 what Hey Jude's going to be to 68. It was like, oh, wow. She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand weren't flukes. This is just like made for radio play, this particular number.
Well, and you mentioned radio play, and I was thinking of that, too. I feel like Hard Day's Night was the album that broke the mold for what radio was doing, which for, at that point, nearly 10 years, what we consider the rock and roll era, had been all about playing the hits. And with A Hard Day's Night, that began to change, and it was the first time that radio stations would play songs that weren't singles or were primarily B-sides. And you look at A Hard Day's Night, and I would say 7 or 8 of the songs on there got regular airplay on radio, on AM radio, at a time when no other album cuts by any other artist were played.
But there's more to it than that. It's because, in some ways, because of Capitol and the U.S. So you had these butchered albums, and it wasn't just Capitol. You had, like, VJ Records out of Chicago put out the early Beatles material in 1963, and no one bought it. People, you can have the greatest thing in the history of mankind, and if people aren't aware of it, or it's not being marketed, the exact same material. So DJs saw this availability of songs, like this is a single. So they were sort of all like loosely single. We don't talk about them as, I mean, I'll Cry Instead was a single. It wasn't what the Beatles thought of as a single, what the official history doesn't suggest. The official history, we go by the discography of Parlophone in the UK. That's how I've always looked at it. But it was sort of a free-for-all, like a chum. and you could just dip into the water and find this hunk of meat and throw that out there, and that was on the radio, and you were filling up that content because of the demand. But the way that you got like five songs all at the start of the chart was, it wasn't because like EMI intended to have them all come out that way. It was the spirit of the free-for-all. And that free-for-all was what we now think of as Beatlemania. But we've also moved away from properly assessing with it. I mean, Bob Dylan's driving down the road. He's hearing these songs, and he has like this crisis of the soul and conscience where he pulls over and thinks, what am I doing with my life? I'm like folk singer Bob Dylan. I'm freewheeling, but these guys they're in another galaxy. It caused him to reinvent himself as an artist. I don't know that Revolver could cause you to reinvent yourself as an artist. I think you only really get that. It is so radical what they were writing and what they were daring to do on that A Hard Day's Night record. It's like avant-garde art that's so populist that we've lost sight of how avant-garde it was in some ways.
To underscore what you were saying about labels, in 1964, 30 different Beatles singles hit the Billboard charts. And yes, on Capitol Records, but also VJ, as you mentioned, Swan, MGM, a label I have not heard of called Tolly. And so Atco released the old Ain't She Sweet with Tony Sheridan, 30 different singles on the Billboard charts that one year.
If you go on the blog, there's an entry, a recent entry about There's a Place. The image, the illustration for that particular entry is the Tolly single of There's a Place. It says Tolly right on it. So even There's a Place, put another way about There's a Place. Not only is it the first mature grown-up rock and roll song, it's sort of like the first official big-time rock and roll album track. It is an album track. It's not a single. You see what I'm saying? Mm. And yet, it was a single. Certain songs are just, they're album tracks. That doesn't mean that they're lesser. It means that they're different in, like, obviously, A Day in the Life couldn't have been a single. It's just I'm not saying that people wouldn't have bought it and it would have gone to number one. It's more of an aesthetic thing. It's just not a single. It's an album track. More specifically, it's an apocalyptic album closer. That's what that song does. That's its function. There's a Place has its function on Please Please Me. It's not a single, but if you were a Richard Kimball in short pants driving around the New England area, you could have been like, wow, There's a Place is on the radio a lot. Whoa, this is just so amazing. I love this.
We're talking Beatles with Colin Fleming on Downtown. We've discussed the film A Hard Day's Night before, and we think of it as such a great music film, but even without that, it's just such a unique and well-made movie that stood so far apart from anything else that you could see in your local cinema back in 1964.
Musical, travelogue, a screwball comedy, absurdist fare, buddy film. It's post-kitchen sink realism remnant. It's a lot of different things. And again, I've mentioned that Jean Vigo, people don't know who he is a French filmmaker, died early. We've talked about him. La Adelante, Zero for Conduct. These are just radical, avant-garde, history-shaping attempts at experiments in cinema that hold together really well. There's an element of that from director Richard Lester in A Hard Day's Night. Think of when they're on the train. There's a reason the music works so well with the images. A train sort of boxes and funnels energy. It puts it into narrow pathways, that kind of thing. It's perfect for the music of A Hard Day's Night. They're in the compartment with the old man and Bet You're Sorry You Won the War. Then they're outside on a bike as the train's going. Think of how smart this was. I remember watching this for the first time at 14 years old, thinking, thank you for not treating me like a moron. You didn't explain this to me. We've talked about this so many times, talked about it with Dark March. Just have the thing be what it is. You don't have to explain it away. When you explain it away, you undercut the world that you've created. It makes sense that they're out there on the side of the train as the train's moving. It makes sense that they're chatting up Patty Boyd and friends in the back compartment, and all of a sudden there are instruments in their hands. And the teacher, when he was showing that in eighth grade, he wasn't like, he didn't even explain it. I don't think he knew what was going on. He probably wasn't paying attention. But I just remember thinking, this is wild. This is so free. What the hell is this? So, again, it's that spirit of the zenith of their art. I've seen this film so many times. There is nothing that I receive it in a similar way to. And that's how I always feel when I watch it, that I'm receiving something, that something is happening to me.
And, of course, Beatlemania was full-on, had been going for over a year in Great Britain, had been going for a solid 5-6 months here in the States at the time. But how important was that movie to propelling the Beatles into the stratosphere?
That movie and that album together in tandem, that was as big as you got. That was, the Beatles had two sort of moments where they were shaping the culture at their most overt way. That's A Hard Day's Night, and that's Pepper. That doesn't mean that Hey Jude wasn't ubiquitous in 1968. They had two of those moments where they were the thing in the world. That's one thing to be the thing in the world. Charlie Sheen was the thing in the world once for like 5 days or whatever it is. They were changing the world in those moments, never more so than in 1964 with A Hard Day's Night. Album and film. They worked together in partnership, like Lennon and McCartney, really. And we have to remember, too, the next year, so we're February of 1963, when we started talking about Please Please Me, we are a year away from Ed Sullivan, almost a year to the day. Mm. That's what happened on February 9th. On February 11th, a second February 11th, the Beatles are giving their first concert in Washington. And it's just this dynamic, amazing performance. They start with Roll Over Beethoven, which is sung by George Harrison. The reason they start with Roll Over Beethoven, sung by George Harrison, who is like a distant third at best at that point, is because it's the Chuck Berry number, and they think this might help them go over better with the audience. They're still not sure of themselves. Then they get into the next number, From Me to You, Lennon McCartney, co-lead vocals. And it's like these guys are pushing each other out of the way to just rip the hide off this song. It's like the most amped up you will hear anyone. And I wonder if somewhere in their minds they were thinking, a year ago at this time, we were banging out those takes of There's a Place, and they still couldn't have known what was going to happen with A Hard Day's Night.
Keep your eyes open when it comes out for Giving You Everything, A Hard Day's Night, and the artistic zenith of the Beatles. In the meantime, go to Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog and read any of Colin's great work on the Beatles. Colin, always a pleasure. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good.